I want to preach this morning on this story from 2 Kings chapter 5 about Naaman, the great warrior of another country, actually, not of Israel, but a nearby country. The supreme commander, basically, of the army of this other country. And I remembered in between the services, I hadn't thought about this before, but I used to have a friend named Grady Austin, whose father was Under Secretary of War during World War II. And Grady at the time was just a little tyke. And sometime during the war, General Eisenhower, who was the supreme commander of Allied forces, came to Grady's home to see his dad. And Grady heard that the supreme commander was coming to their home. And, of course, first Secret Service men showed up, and then Marine guards and people, you know, all around the house, and then limousines came and more soldiers out in front. And then Eisenhower, who was a very commanding presence in any event, came into the home and then went off with Grady's father. Grady told me that he actually thought Eisenhower was God. That was his understanding as a little kid. The supreme commander is coming to see my dad. Right? And, of course, he saw all of the activity and the rush and the soldiers and how important this clearly was when this, long before he even arrived, all of the activity began. And then when he arrived, of course, there was a big entourage with him, and they swept through the house and then off into his dad's office for this meeting. And so Grady, in his child's mind, thought, God has just come to my house. And he thought Dwight Eisenhower was God. Now, I remembered that story because Naaman is effectively Dwight Eisenhower in this story. He has the same power. He is second in power only to the king. And Naaman has won great victories for his king. And he is a very, very powerful man. But in spite of his great power, he has leprosy, and nothing has been able to be done about it. You can be sure that he was to all the best doctors, probably even to the priests of the God that they worshipped, which was not the God of Israel. And none of them could heal him. All of his money and his wealth and his power couldn't get him healed. And then what's so interesting in this is a servant girl, a slave, taken in one of their conquests, assigned to his wife as a maid, says, there is a prophet in Israel who could probably heal my master. It wasn't the best known doctor in his country that said this. It wasn't the top priest who said this. A servant girl, a person of no account in their society, said, there's a prophet in Israel who I think could heal my master. And so Naaman gets permission, gets a letter which is sent to the king of Israel, loads up 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 outfits, which you can imagine were very regal and impressive. And a letter is sent to the king of Israel, which of course scares the you-know-what out of the king. He reads the letter and it says that Naaman is coming to be healed of his leprosy. And the king's reaction is, what am I, God? I can't do that. And Elisha, this is the disciple of Elijah, sends word to the king, send him to me and I'll heal him. Because there is a prophet in Israel. Now Elisha, for his part, was a farmer. When he was called by Elijah, the prophet, he was walking behind a bunch of oxen, plowing a field. This is not a man of any account either. And in fact, right now, he's living only under the good graces of a Shunammite woman who feeds him. So this is not a man of great power either. And Naaman, the powerful man, comes to Israel with all of his wealth and all of his show and a huge entourage, as you might imagine, and they ride to Elisha's house. And Elisha doesn't even come out. Doesn't even come out. Now, It was not pride on Elisha's part that kept him inside the house. It was the presence of pride in Naaman. Elisha would not meet the general any more than God would. I can imagine, in fact, as we were singing and I was praying here, I began thinking about my own life and those things which I rely upon in my own life. And I know that all of us are this way. When I was in high school, I was a runner, ran cross country and track, and I was a gymnast. My body worked pretty well in those days. Whatever pride I might have had in my physical abilities, gone, it's just not there. I have days when I can barely stand on my left leg because of the damage in my knee. And I weigh way more than I ever thought I would any time in my life, ever. So the Lord has dealt well with the circumstances, or what are called the accidents of my life. Those accidents of place where you're born, genetics, those kinds of things, how much money your parents do or don't have. And so the Lord was showing this to me as I was praying here, and I was really laughing about how much I had trusted in those things. And he said, you know, this is true about your brain, too. It isn't just about your body. I mean, you didn't make any of these things. I did. And they're not who I meet when I meet you. Those are just the accidents of your life. When I meet you, it's you that I meet, not those things that you identify with so often. And that's what happened to Naaman here. To Naaman, he was a powerful warrior. And that powerful, rich warrior rode to meet Elisha. And Elisha had no interest in that proud, rich warrior, nor did God, for that matter, in the accidents of his life, the circumstances of his life. But God did intend to meet the one that he had made, the man that he had made, who was now a leper. And so Elisha just sent word out, tell him to go dip himself in the Jordan 7 times, and he'll be fine. Now, the contrast that I would use is imagine that, we'll just pick Dwight Eisenhower because I started my story with him, has leprosy. He's been to all the best doctors in the country, and a servant girl who works for his wife says, well, I'm from Puerto Rico, and there's a prophet in Puerto Rico who can probably heal you. Now, first of all, it's an amazing step for Naaman to go to Israel or for Eisenhower to go to Puerto Rico, little island of no account, floating out there in the middle of the ocean. In Puerto Rico, I'm supreme commander of the Allied forces. I'm going to go to little island and look for a prophet there. But, of course, word is sent to the governor of Puerto Rico, Eisenhower is coming. And for the governor, aside from being scared to death, for everybody else there, it's a red-letter day. Eisenhower's coming. Naaman is coming with all of his horses and wealth. Naaman is coming. You never get the opportunity to meet somebody like that in normal life. He's coming. And, of course, the prophet doesn't even come out. And what does Naaman do? Does he say, well, all right, I'll do what he said. He stomps off, he stalks away in a rage because his power has not been acknowledged. His importance has not been acknowledged. He expects with all the wealth that he has brought with him that Elisha will be privileged to come and heal him and will come out and will say, oh Lord of heaven, please heal this great man. And he'll wave his hands and pray, and Naaman will be healed. Instead, the guy who lives in the little hut where a woman feeds him in the remote areas of Puerto Rico says, well, there's a little river over there. Go wash yourself in it 7 times. Through an intermediary. Not even directly. And so he's angry about this. He says, aren't my rivers greater? Isn't my country greater? Who is this guy? He stomps off. And another servant in his entourage sort of sends word up through the chain. Now, wait a minute. If God had asked you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? If Elijah had come out and said, if you wish to be healed, you must go to Lebanon and harvest 400 of the greatest trees. And you must bring them here and build a great temple to God. And then you must go to Egypt and bring back 4,000 pounds of gold and line the inside of this temple, and then you will be healed. Naaman would have been off in an instant because he could do that with his power. But Elisha said, oh, go dip yourself in the stream. And Naaman got mad. So Naaman is chastened by the lowly person and goes off and dips himself in the Jordan 7 times and comes up with baby skin. That's what it says. Baby skin. Born again. Baby skin. And then he says, surely there, not only is there a prophet in Israel, the God of Israel is the God. That is the only God, and the only God I will ever worship. And I would encourage you to read the rest of chapter 5 of 2 Kings. It's an extraordinary story. Now, how does this apply to us? The truth is, I think for believers, and I'm going to talk about unbelievers in a moment, for believers, sometimes we imagine that what God is asking of us is some extraordinary feat which the great abilities that we have, physical, mental, whatever, somehow will allow us to do. And I think what God wants from us is very simple stuff. Very simple. Easily explained. Love justice, do mercy, care for those who are in need, love God, love your neighbor as yourself, share the good news. That's it. Pretty simple. There have been people that I've known in this congregation and elsewhere who have said, I'd like to teach in our congregation. There are some things that I really feel that I'd be able to teach the folks here. But when asked to do something like vacuum the rug or clean up in the kitchen, I don't do that. God is looking for simple obedience from us. It's not hard, it's not great, it's just simple obedience. And it's the obedience of the heart of a person willing to vacuum or wipe a counter clean. It's that heart which he empowers to teach. And I'm not saying this in any way to credit myself at all, but rather for all of us to consider. What God desires from us is simple, very, very simple. It is not some great thing. There may be great consequences to something that he calls us to, but that's his work and his job and his responsibility. And whether it's great or small in the world's eyes is none of our concern. God just has simple things of obedience that he calls us to. For unbelievers, it looks like this. And all of us either are or have been in this circumstance. Maybe there is a God. Maybe he really does desire some sort of relationship with me. If that's true, then the way he can prove himself to me is by meeting me in this way, meeting these needs, helping me understand him in this way. In fact, he'd better be this way. Basically, what we're saying to God is, if you want a relationship with me, here are my terms. I don't know, how silly is that? We've just come up to the one who with a word created the universe. And we've said, here are the terms of our relationship. You don't have to be very bright to realize that what's going to work is to say, what are your terms? Right? What are the terms of surrender? We are not in a position to command God or to control God. We are in a position to surrender what is wonderful about Psalm 111, the finish of it. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Awe and reverence for the Lord is the foundation of wisdom. That's when you start to be wise, is when you recognize this is not one that you demand terms of, but rather that you ask terms of. What are your terms? And his terms are very simple. He desires that we live in a loving, obedient relationship with him and with each other. Can't get much simpler than that. He recognizes that we sin and that we don't have enough in ourselves to overcome that. So he says, I'll forgive your sin if you'll just allow me to. Can't get much simpler than that. The problem is that the conditions the gospel places on us are very often repulsive to us. It's not what we want. I don't know who is the author of this, but let me read just a couple of sentences here. We might swear that it is night when the sun shines, but the light would only prove our insanity. We may curse the book, meaning the Bible, but its truth is inviolable. We may blaspheme the gospel, but the loudness of our voice may only reveal the perfectness of our idiocy. How presumptuous is man! Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as makes the angels weep. I've got to imagine that when God saw Naaman and all of his wealth coming pompously across that plain, that there had to have been both laughter in heaven and weeping, that he could be so far from understanding who the God of the universe was. And it was only when he humbled himself at the counsel of a servant and another servant and a prophet in low circumstances, also a servant, when he humbled himself at the advice of those who the world considered not worthy at all, only when he humbled himself and did the simple thing that God requested, just go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan and you'll be healed. And for each of us, believer or unbeliever, God says the same thing. The instruction is simple. Come before me knowing that your pride and your strength and your wealth will never save you, but merely ask for forgiveness and it's yours. That's the good news. And the good news is independent of anything that we think we bring to the relationship. It is not the accident of our life that he sees or honors. It's just us, just me, the simplest person that I am, just me, that he desires and that he calls into relationship with him. And so my prayer for myself and for each of us is, Lord, help us shed our pride. Help us shed our excuses. Help us shed the idiocy of each of us as we come before you with conditions and ways in which we are going to control you and your effect in our lives. Please help us just set all of that aside. And Lord, help our prayer be just this one. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Amen.